From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1990 when Congress was debating a piece of legislation that had the potential to change the lives and opportunities of people with disabilities. The Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 is a civil rights law that prohibits discrimination based on disability. It also requires covered employers to provide reasonable accommodations to employees with disabilities while also imposing accessibility requirements on public accommodations. But it was not a slam dunk to pass. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce lobbied hard against it, arguing that the costs of the ADA would be enormous and have a disastrous impact on many small businesses struggling to survive. And NFIB, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, called the ADA a disaster for small business. Well, shortly before the act faced a vote, disability rights activists engaged in what was called a capital crawl. They shed their wheelchairs and crutches and other assistive devices, and they pulled their bodies up all 100 of the front Capitol steps. As they did so, many chanted, "ADA now." President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act in July of 1990. Iowa Senator Tom Harkin authored the final bill and was its chief sponsor in the Senate. Today, Tom Harkin is 3 years into retirement from his 30 in the Senate, but he's still working. He's in Rochester today as a guest of the Rock Employability Summit. That event, happening tomorrow, is a day-long event at the Strong Museum of Play, focusing on increasing employment and decreasing poverty among people with disabilities. And consider this. The poverty rate of people with disabilities in Rochester is the highest of any mid-sized to large city in our country. Rochester's poverty rate for people with some disability is 42.1%. I will welcome now our guest for the hour, retired Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa, here in studio with us. Nice to have you, Senator.
Evan, it's nice to be back in Rochester.
All right. Also with us is Stephanie Woodward, Director of Advocacy for the Center for Disability Rights. Stephanie, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, J.D. Flores, member of the Planning Committee for the Rock Employability Conference. J.D., welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Susan Hetherington is director of the University of Rochester's Strong Center for Developmental Disabilities. Susan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much.
You know, Stephanie, I thought of you when I was reading the story of the Capitol crawl, the story of the advocacy that was happening in those days before the ADA, because, of course, you, among many others, have engaged in works of advocacy and public demonstration as well. Do you see any parallel to what you've done recently in that?
I do. I am lucky to be the next generation of ADAPT, which is a disability rights grassroots organization that fights for people to live in freedom and instead of institutional settings. And I'm proud to say that ADAPT worked with Senator Harkin back when I was not even born yet, in order to get the ADA to pass. So the ADA finally passed and was signed into law when I was 2 years old, and it wouldn't be for the work that the senator did with ADAPT back then. And so ADAPT continues to continue to fight for disability rights, to enforce and enhance our rights, because the fight's not over.
Senator, do you remember the Capitol crawl?
Oh, just like it was yesterday, Evan. I've always had this warm feeling for ADAPT. Well, they can be a bit cantankerous, let me tell you that, first of all.
Thank you.
Yeah, Stephanie's going to take that as a compliment.
And I just love ADAPT. I always refer to ADAPT as sort of the Marine Corps of the disability rights movement. They're sort of the first to hit the beach. They take the most casualties, but they break down the barriers. They are the ones that ADAPT back in the 80s, when I first started working on this bill, were the ones that would lie down under the wheels of Greyhound buses so they couldn't move. They're the ones that would chain themselves across Constitution Avenue in Washington, D.C. At rush hour traffic. They were the ones that did the Capitol crawl with people like Bob Kofkin. Jennifer Heelan, I think, was the 8-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. Is that her name, Stephanie?
Yeah. Yes.
The second grader, yeah.
Yeah, and she was magnificent. She was just magnificent because there was a camera that came up, and when the cameraman came up and said something to her about, there was a policeman saying to Jennifer, this 8-year-old girl crawling up the Capitol steps, that you have to stop doing this. And she said, 8-year-old girl said, why don't you stop that man? She pointed to a guy who was walking up the steps. She said, this is the only way I can get up. It was just so profound. I mean, and that Capitol crawl, that was in March of 1990. See, I shouldn't go into this. We had passed the ADA, my bill, in September in 89 in the Senate.
Yep.
We couldn't get it through the House. It got all bollocksed up. And we knew we wanted to get it done before summer, before we got into another election campaign and all that. And but we couldn't get it out of the House. So the Capitol crawl, once that happened, got on national TV, got in all media. We got out of the House, I think, within 20-some days after that. Boom, right through. That was the end of it.
So for anybody who doubts the power of activism, that was just one of the reminders, a very visual and vivid reminder. And Senator Harkin, you also, at times, would communicate with sign language on the floor to kind of send a message, and I know it was personal to you. Tell
yes.
us about that.
Well, I started on this. I had an older brother who was disabled. He was deaf. And I saw how he'd been discriminated against in his lifetime. First of all, he was taken from our home in a small town in Iowa, sent halfway across the state to the Iowa School for the Deaf and Dumb.
That was the name of the school?
Well, it wasn't, but that's what everybody called it.
Okay, okay.
And so I remember a couple of things my brother told me that stuck with me forever, and that was, I may be deaf, but I'm not dumb. And so he was segregated away from everybody in school. When he graduated, they told him he could only be one of three things. He could be a baker, a shoe cobbler, or a printer's assistant. And they asked him which one he wanted to be, and he said, I don't want to be any of those things. So they said, okay, you're going to be a baker. He had no choice. And then I saw how he was discriminated against in a lot of things, whether it's shopping. But he was determined to be independent. He was a strong-willed individual that wanted to be independent, didn't want any pity, wanted to make his own way, and was one of the first deaf persons in Iowa to actually get a driver's license because he was told he couldn't drive a car because he was deaf. But he passed all the tests. This would be in 1948, I think. About 1948. And so I saw that. And so my first work when I went to Congress was mostly focused on deafness, communication disorders. And then so when I was on the Senate floor and the ADA passed, I thought I would give my speech on it in sign language. And it was kind of a funny occasion because I started speaking in sign language. Well, the court reporter had no idea what I was saying. Mm. Senator Bob Kerry from Nebraska was sitting in the chair. He didn't know what to do either. And so there was this kind of flurry of activity down in the well. What could they do? Well, I finished my speech, then I gave it verbally. It was just kind of an odd moment in the Senate because no one knew what I was saying.
And probably revelatory of the challenges that people can face when all of a sudden very few can communicate.
You know, the other thing I want to say is about the ADA. This was a classic bipartisan bill. First of all, we had this great support of the President of the United States, George H.W. Bush. He really pushed hard on this. He stood behind it all the way. In fact, to the point of pushing his chief of staff, John Sununu, out of the road and replacing him with another person to make sure we could get it through. Interesting story. So he was just wonderful in backing us up from the White House. One thing, if I could correct, it stuck in my mind
okay,
in your
sure.
opening. You said the Chamber of Commerce was opposed to it. They weren't. They were initially.
They came around?
Oh, yes, they did. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce actually supported the final bill.
The final bill. There's all kinds of quotes early on. Oh. NFIB, the Chamber of Commerce, warning that this will cripple small businesses.
Oh, I know. Well, NFIB never supported it.
Okay.
Never.
But the Chamber came around.
The Chamber did. They absolutely did. There was one leader, Tom Donahue, at the Chamber at that time, who decided they would support it. Well, we made some changes and compromises in it, but they did support it. And we got broad support from Republicans and Democrats across the aisle. And I always tell people today about as fractured as our country is right now politically, this is one issue where there has in the past never been party lines, where we can work together across the aisle to bring people together on issues like employment, of persons with disabilities, which I hope we get to because that's what we're here for.
Absolutely.
And that's what I'm focusing my life on. Since I retired, I decided to focus on one thing and one thing only, that is employment of persons with disabilities, in competitive integrated employment. Now, that's kind of a key phrase, competitive integrated employment. Not segregated workshops, not sub-minimum wage, but jobs just like everybody else. And we've got great examples of that all over the country. We made some changes in the vocational rehabilitation law to help get young people into competitive integrated employment. That's the key.
We've got a lot to talk about on that scale this hour. In fact, Senator Harkin's going to tell us a little bit about what he's going to be speaking about in his presentation tomorrow at this event. And for the listeners, who I don't know what Tom's talking about when he says that the country seems fractured right now, but we will ask him later this hour a little bit of how he sees the current political landscape and how much he misses being in Washington. I'm sure he misses it dearly these days. But before we get there, let's talk a little bit about what's coming up tomorrow. And Susan Hetherington, I'll start with you. Give me the overview for what you hope to accomplish with the event tomorrow, vis-a-vis poverty, employment, and competitive, integrative employment.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. I'm so glad that Senator Harkin focused on competitive, integrated employment, because being employed in a sheltered workshop or receiving sub-minimum wage is not what we want to be seeing. It's part of what's led to the poverty of people with disabilities throughout the country, but in particularly here in Rochester. We are doing this summit because we were horrified when we learned about the poverty rate caused by the unemployment and underemployment of people with disabilities. At Strong Center for Developmental Disabilities, employment has long been one of our focus areas. And we've been quite successful with a number of programs like Project Search, and we now have a job club. But the reality is that the community, that businesses and agencies are not hiring people with disabilities. And until they do, that poverty rate is going to continue. So the summit is a problem-solving day to both inform and work on the issue of unemployment and poverty.
And I will say, both Stephanie and JD looked at me when I said, boy, I was surprised at Rochester's rate, because maybe I was hopeful. I mean, Stephanie Woodward is someone whose face has been on national publications because of some of the advocacy work. Though Stephanie reminds me every time we talk about this, that could have been anybody who was demonstrating that day. It happened to be you recently. But I thought, you know, Rochester is, you work here in Rochester. There's a lot of emphasis and work on this. And yet here we are with a poverty rate for people with disabilities in Rochester of 42.1%. And JD and Stephanie looked at me and said, we're not surprised. You're not surprised.
No, I'm not surprised because, you know, segregation is a healthy sport in this community, in my humble opinion. Again, I can only speak for myself, and I can only speak to what I know being true. But if you think about, let's talk about when you shop. Let's talk about when you're out and about in the community. Let's talk about when you're going to a public setting, a restaurant. How many times do you see people with disabilities? How often is that to you? Like, I've noticed them, you know, my friends notice them, my family members and people who work with people with disabilities notice them, because that's our life every day. Those are our teammates. That's who we're looking for when we go into different spaces. But those folks who don't have that connection, how oftentimes do they see them? Because we're not necessarily given the opportunities, or the platforms aren't necessarily shared with us in order for us to move up in a company, move up in an organization, or even have the opportunity to just start. So I have to work my way up to an interview and then earn that interview. And then I have to be almost a perfect candidate at that interview to almost get that job, maybe. And if someone comes in after me that just, you know, had one thing different than me, then I lost out because of what the perceptions people have of me and whatever my chair represents to them. My chair's name is Clyde, so if I've referenced Clyde anywhere through this, that's who I'm talking about. But, you know, Clyde is part of my identity. He makes me comfortable in the spaces that I'm in and where I'm going to go. And if Clyde can't come, I can't come. You know, like there's places here I don't shop because they're not accessible. You know, there's all these other different things that I don't do because they don't align up with my moral code of life. But in a lot of the spaces that we're in, we look at all the employers in the city. There's employers who employ 50,000 plus people in the city. And when you walk through there, how many times do you see folks with disabilities? You know, there's other smaller companies and there's local businesses. How many of those local businesses are actually accessible? Like, how many of them are actually giving people a chance? Now, I'm not trying to shame anyone. There are, you know, people who do. But what I'm saying is that the majority don't. And when that happens is when you start talking about expendable wage. Well, we don't have expendable wage. So that's why we wouldn't be in your restaurants. We wouldn't be in your stores because we have no way to make money. And then, you know, if we want to talk on a larger scale of issues, we want to talk about systems. The systems we have in place sometimes hold us back. I went to college. I graduated high school. I'm local. So local all the way. I graduated from Wilson Magnet High School in 2009. I went to Brockport. It's not really local, but it's close enough, in my opinion, to be local. I graduated from Brockport in 2014, and I have yet to find gainful employment where it's not just a year-long contract, or I'm not just a part-timer, or I'm not just a person to come in to volunteer for you or to work for free. Like, it hasn't happened. Now, you can't tell me I don't have the skill, because if I pull my resume out, you'll be surprised. And then you look at me and say, how don't you have a position yet? And it's because the perception of people with disabilities, you know, we have to change our narrative. We have to change the way people look at us. We have to basically really just revamp how people see us and view us, because we've been second-class citizens for a long time. And so there's a lot of issues that I'm hitting, and it's hard to really just talk about in an hour, but to me, those are some of the bigger issues that as a city we have to address, and we have to say, oh no, we're going to stop that here. We're going to change the culture, and we're going to create initiatives, you know, to create change. We're going to say, oh, so we haven't hired folks with disabilities, you know, in the past, but okay, this year we've decided we're going to take on an initiative to hire 10. And I don't care what disability it is. It could be anything. Because what matters to me is that when I walk into a store and I see someone that looks like me or they may have a disability, I feel like, oh my God, they saw me for that second because they hired that one kid, and it makes me happy. And my friends do it too. Like, so it's weird because they shouldn't do that. I feel like I should have taught them better. But, you know, if they see someone in a position they feel like I could have, they get excited because they're like, oh, well, you could go after that now too because I see someone that looks like you there.
So when JD says, when we use the word we are going to make change, I want to ask first Stephanie and then Senator Tom Harkin about this issue, because in my mind, when I'm hearing JD describe applying for a job and feeling like you have to be perfect, because if you get somebody else who's equal to you in resume but doesn't have a disability, a visible disability, whatever the case may be, you're going to lose out on that job. You feel like you have to be ahead of everybody else, probably by a lot. Otherwise, somebody comes in and you lose the chance. So I'm wondering if we need a cultural change that puts pressure on employers, our communities, et cetera, to change from within, or do we need remedies from the government? I mean, what's the combination that's going to, and I'll start with Stephanie, what's going to change this?
I never think that one strategy is okay. The right strategy to go. I always, in ADAPT, we have a pitchfork approach where we use multiple strategies at the same time. So I think legislatively, it's important to keep enforcing our rights under the ADA. Every time someone's discriminated against, what is really unfortunate is that they're unaware of their rights. So they don't know how to enforce them. And I think enforcement sometimes is what makes employers, gives them the incentive to actually comply. Because if one company sees a business sued for discrimination, company next door might not make that same mistake. But at the same time, we do need a cultural change. Just like JD, I grew up with a father who told me that you need to be smarter than everybody else in order to be viewed as maybe equal. And it's really unfortunate that that's what I was taught, but it's really practical because I don't know that I would be employed right now if I didn't take that to heart. And I'm lucky in that the only jobs I've ever applied for have been disability rights positions because I'm an attorney. If I wanted to be an attorney in tax law, I might not have a firm that wants to hire me. Luckily, in disability rights law, I'm a hot commodity because I represent exactly what we're fighting for. So that's great for me. But what about people who just want to work in different jobs. Not every disabled person wants to work in disability rights. It's an exhausting field, and you shouldn't have to fight for your rights as your job every day when you have to do it in the community every evening. But I do think that it's necessary to have a societal change, especially since disabled people, there is a stereotype and stigma that we're either objects to be pitied or, at best, and at worst, we're burdens on society that need to go away. And that's not the case. We don't want your pity. We want jobs. We want to live in the community. We want to not be segregated. We don't want to be pushed away into institutional settings. We want to be in the community. But we also want to be paid fair wages. In New York State, it's still legal to pay people sub-minimum wage.
Is that number one on the list right now? If you had a legislative priority list to change that you could grab one, two, three, is that number one?
For me, I think my number one is getting people out of institutions. We still have a lot of people who have the same disabilities that JD and I have that have every ability to live and work and be free in the community who are stuck in nursing homes and other institutions simply because insurance will put them there but not allow them to have attendance in the community. So that's a huge problem, which is why we're working on the Disability Integration Act legislatively. But on a statewide level, we certainly do advocate against subminimum wage. There are other states who have outlawed this. Vermont outlawed it over 10 years ago. And yet New York, that claims to be this progressive state where everybody's equal and wage parity and everybody should have a higher wage, why are we leaving disabled people behind? Mm-hmm.
Senator Harkin, when you look at legislative remedy, or maybe I'll just frame the question to you the same way I sent it over to Stephanie. Is it a cultural society change, employers making decisions on their own goodwill, or is this a case where there's legislative remedy for the state of poverty, for the state of unemployment, for people with disabilities?
Well, both. We do have some legislative remedies that we've enacted, obviously. Both in the ADA, the ADA Act amendments, the Rehab Act, others that are out there now that do provide some legislative remedies. But a lot of it has to do with what I call attitudinal barriers. It's been said before by others that the biggest barriers that we had to break down in the Americans with Disabilities Act were not the physical barriers, but the attitudinal barriers that people have and still have. They see a person like JD with a disability, and they say, oh, what kind of a disability job do we have for her? Well, that's kind of the narrow framework they think about. What we really have to do is to start working with businesses, and that's why this summit tomorrow is so important. Let me put it this way. I've never yet found a private sector business who, when they went out of their way to reach out in an affirmative action to hire persons with disabilities, provided the perhaps the modifications that might be needed for that person to do that job for which they are qualified. I've never found one yet that didn't say they were the best employees they've ever had. The best. I'll give you an example. I was at Walgreens in right outside of Hartford, Connecticut, a couple of years ago. They employ about 800 people in a distribution center. 40% of the people that work there are persons with disabilities. 40%. The CEO at that time, Doug Wasson, took us around. He said, some people you'll recognize with a disability, some you won't. They're just intermingled with everybody else. Fully integrated, in competitive integrated employment, paid the same health benefits, same retirement benefits, same pay as anybody else. And he said something that stuck with me. He said, Doug Wasson, the CEO, said, I want you to know I don't do this out of the goodness of my heart. This is the most productive distribution center I have in the United States. We found that when we hired persons with disabilities, number one, and they learn the job, they make fewer mistakes than anybody else. They're always on time. They never get sick. And he said, plus, we find that when we hire a person with a disability and integrate them into our employment sector, like everybody else, we save a ton of money every year on training because they don't leave. They stay there. And so he said, we've saved a lot of money on training new people all the time. So businesses need to understand this. Businesses also should understand that they need to work in their diversity portfolio, put persons with disabilities in there, not just race, sex, that type. Put disability in their diversity portfolio. Set goals set goals. I at my last summit in Washington, we have a harkinsummit.org you can look up, but we have a summit on employment.
Harkinsummit.org.
Yes. Every year we have an international conference on employment of persons with disabilities. I challenged last year that in 10 years, let's double the rate of employment of persons with disabilities over 10 years. Let's just double it. Whatever it is in your locality, just double it. I don't know a lot about Rochester. I saw the figures that you cited there, Evan. But I think there's just a lot of times, a lot of inertia. I think a lot in the private business sector, maybe just, well, they just haven't gotten around to it. It just hasn't been something they've kind of embraced. I think there's a lot of fear, unfounded fear among employers that if they hire someone with a disability that they can't do this, they can't fire them, they can't do this. That's just not so. And I want to make one thing also very clear. I have never asked an employer to ever hire a person with a disability for a job for which that person was not qualified. That's not the point of this. The point is this: if you're qualified, then ADA says, well, reasonable accommodations, and that varies from business to business, reasonable accommodations, so that you can do the job for which you are qualified. So I think if we do those things, and I have to mention this one other thing. It came up, Medicaid bias. A lot of times, a person with a disability, and especially coming out of nursing homes and everything, and living independently, right now in Medicaid, if you are Medicaid qualified, a person with a disability, Medicaid must pay for you to live in a nursing home. If, however, you say, I don't want to live in a nursing home, I'm capable of living on my own in a community setting, and all I need is some supportive services, Medicaid doesn't have to pay for that. Doesn't have to pay for that.
That could be a legislative change, couldn't it?
We've tried for a long time.
So we're still trying with the Disability Integration Act.
Who opposes it? Who opposes that?
Well, there are some nursing facilities that oppose it because they feel that it will cause them to shut down, and we feel that people should have the right to the services as opposed to the setting. So right now, Medicaid is, as a mandatory benefit, is required to pay for nursing facility services, but not required to give those same services in the community. So the Disability Integration Act says that if an insurance company, whether it's Medicaid or a private insurer, would pay for that nursing facility setting, they must also pay for those same services in the community, so that your right is to the services as opposed to the setting.
And again, that sounds pretty logical.
And I want to point out one other thing.
Yeah.
We have good data now. After many years, we have good data that a state will pay less money in supportive services for a person with a disability to live in the community than they're paying for them to live in a nursing home. So it's not a budget issue. We've shown that. There's plenty of data to show that.
Evan, can I answer the same question? I think that it's something. I'm sorry, I'm kind of losing my thoughts because this is like what I do.
But it's no problem.
But I think it's something that has to happen in tandem. I think what happens is we don't have accountability. So I think that the legislation, whatever it is that could come about, I'm not a lawyer, I study sociology, but whatever it is that could come about is something that can hold businesses accountable. I think that that's where we fall short when discussing employment for people with disabilities. We're not holding anyone accountable as to why you didn't hire someone with a disability, why it didn't fall into your diversity plan, why is it okay for you to ask people if they're disabled, you know, because these questionnaires do exist. And I don't know where that information goes, but I know that I had to click that button in order to get further in your application. So there's things that I think and legislatively can happen to hold people accountable as to why they're not hiring people with disabilities. But then in the community, we also have to hold ourselves accountable for what we're not doing, right? So we have plenty of, you know, festivals, whatever you want to call it in the community events that aren't accessible. Or we have community events that aren't necessarily welcoming safe spaces for people with disabilities. So we need to hold ourselves accountable for what we're not doing as community members for people with disabilities, because we are part of the community just like everyone else. But accountability has to happen on both sides. And in tandem, it can happen with the community changing its perspective on something as basic as a community event and then growing into those spaces where money is being exchanged. Because if we come to, you know, if we speak in reality, we only really care about money as a country. So when we start talking about dollars, when I can tell you that it costs you $10,000 to house me in a nursing home, home every month versus the $2,000 it might cost you to let me live in a house. I think that that could work differently. But when you've done this for so long, you start understanding what the language is that people want to hear. So I've been an advocate since I was a kid. I didn't have a choice. My parents came to this country because to give me a better option. My parents left Puerto Rico, their safe little haven, to come here to give me a better option. Who knows what would have happened to me had not. But if I didn't become an advocate because they didn't speak English, I don't know where I would be. So we have to address that. And then we also obviously have to address the educational issues that we have in this community. You know, kids with disabilities aren't being educated in the right way. So we're not even producing candidates to have jobs. So it's a lot of little issues that we have to address that legislation could hold people accountable. Because if you didn't do this, this is what now happens to you, in my opinion. But again, I'm just a sociologist.
No, I take your point. But Stephanie Woodward, before we get to our only break of the hour, help me understand who is standing in the way of this kind of legislation.
Well,
you've been in Washington enough to probably know.
I just got back yesterday.
I imagine.
So there are people who are currently up for re-election that you might want to, whether it's locally in the House or there's 33 Senate seats, I believe, reach out and ask them if they support the Disability Integration Act. And if not, ask their opponents if they do. And I think everyone will be able to find out who really opposes this. There are certainly members on both sides of the aisle that haven't joined on to the Disability Integration Act, whether it's just that they haven't gotten around to it or if they're opposed. But we are working on it, and we are working on dispelling this idea that it costs more to let us live in freedom, because we believe it's a constitutional right for everybody to have life and liberty, including disabled people. And you don't have any life or liberty when you're locked away in an institution.
All right. As we head to break, I will tell our listeners we've got a couple of comments from listeners who have a lot of appreciation for Senator Harkin. We'll get those a phone call and an email when we come back for that. Senator Tom Harkin is our guest, a retired senator from Iowa, served in the U.S. Senate for 30 years before retiring 3 years ago. Some would say it just the right time. You're also hearing from Stephanie Woodward, Director of Advocacy for the Center for Disability Rights, J.D. Flores, Member of the Planning Committee for the ROC Employability Conference, which is tomorrow. That's why Senator Harkin is here. He'll be speaking to that group tomorrow that's going to be focusing on employment, poverty, and opportunity in hiring for people with disabilities. And Susan Hetherington's here, Director of the University of Rochester Strong Center for Developmental Disabilities. As some listeners may know, last year the WXXI Newsroom produced a podcast called Exited about young people with disabilities transitioning into adulthood. The first episode focused on high school, special education, and what it takes to graduate if you're a student with disabilities. Tomorrow, WXXI is hosting a live event to listen to some of this episode, discuss some of these issues, and also talk about what went into making the series with podcast producer Veronica Volk and the subject of the episode, Nate Taylor and his parents. The event is going to be right here at WXXI Studios. It is open to the public tomorrow, 6 p.m. Please join us here. You can get all the details at WXXINews.org. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, an upcoming event takes aim at the issue of gentrification. How do they define it? And who is impacted? You'll meet some of them Thursday. Then in our second hour, Rochester gets ready to celebrate not just Columbus Day, but Indigenous Peoples Day. Should they celebrate both or one or the other? We'll talk about it. Join us on Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Greg in Rochester on the phone's been waiting. Go ahead, Greg.
Hi. I wanted to thank the senator and the individuals on the panel for the tireless work to constantly, you know, improve upon the ADA and provide more opportunity with people with disabilities. A lot of my family members, they have food allergies, which was added as an amendment to the ADA in the 2000s. And it's been immensely helpful in providing protections and opportunity for my children and my family to be able to go to events, go to school, and go to restaurants and know that, you know, we have a right to be protected. And I just wanted to express my thanks for all the work that everyone's doing and for what the center has done.
Greg, thank you for that.
Well,
Tom?
Well, Greg, thank you very much. A lot of people working on this, a lot of good people. And, you know, if you look back, we've come quite a ways. In accessibility, respectability, The one place we've fallen down, and that's why I wanted to focus on, is employment. The ADA had four goals, Evan: full participation, equal opportunity, independent living, economic self-sufficiency. And the first three, we've done all right. Independent living, we're still trying to get that one down. But it's the jobs that we haven't moved the needle on. So we've come quite a ways. But to me, the big thing is employment. Employment, employment, in competitive integrated employment.
Well, let me also read this email from Barbara, who sends this note. It says, I'm a native Iowan who now lives in New York. Please let Senator Harkin know he is greatly missed in the Senate. I understand his wanting to retire, but we could use him there now. And Senator Harkin, when you were getting ready for retirement, you told PBS's Judy Woodruff that a lot had changed. That, for example, you used to really start work for constituents on Monday at noon, go to Friday at noon or beyond. It really became a Tuesday to Thursday constituent job with the rest of the time for raising money. And then things just got toxically sort of partisan to a point that you didn't recognize from when you had started in Washington. How do you view it now, 3 years later?
Wow, I didn't think it could get much worse about the time I left, but it's gotten even worse. The money chase has ruined Congress. Money's always played a part in politics, let's be frank about it. But since the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court, that just opened the floodgates for dark money, hidden money. The idea that a billionaire, can put as much money as he or she wants in their races or any other race. And so it's ratcheted up the cost of running for office to the point where that's the single most important thing a senator or a congressman does during their week: get on the phone and raise money. That's why you have the Tuesday noon to Thursday noon club now. It's just broken down all sense of working together in the Congress. And politics have become more, what's the word I'm searching here for? Personally divisive, personally attacking people and calling into question someone's motives, that type of thing. Now, we've always had bits and pieces of that in the past, but it's become ingrained almost now in the Congress.
You seem sad about it.
It is sad. I mean, I came through a time when Republicans and Democrats worked together. I was in the Senate for five changes, from Democrat to Republican, Democrat, Republican, five times. And I chaired a very important appropriations committee. But then the Republican was Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania. So when the Republicans take over, he's chair and I'm ranking member. The Democrats take over, I'm chair and he's ranking member. And we always said, and actually it was Senator Specter, I'm sorry, he's deceased now, who said it was like a seamless transition. Now, did we agree on everything? No. But we got along, and we sort of generally agreed where we should go. Maybe I wanted to go a little more here. He wanted to go a little bit more there. But that's the art of compromise. And now it's just like it's sort of a winner take all, or it's a zero sum game. If I win, you lose. And that's not the way I ever thought of it.
Well, we're going to get right back to the ADA disabilities employment. I want to ask you one broad-based employment question. And actually, in honor of your visit, we found some audio that you might recognize from 1992 when Tom Harkin was very nearly president of the United States. He won the Iowa caucuses in 1992. A lot of the polls said he was going to win the Democratic nomination. And had you known Ross Perot was going to be in the race, you would have been planning to outfit the White House at the time.
That's right.
So this is from the 1992 Democratic primaries. And take a listen.
All over America, I see empty factories, the dashed hopes and dreams of working people all over this country. When I look around and I see this empty factory here, I see the legacy of George Bush's economic policies. You can look down this hallway, and you can hear the echoes. You can hear the echoes of the people that once worked here.
They were good citizens. They fought our wars and they paid their taxes. And they worked in these plants to make our country better. And what I hear when I hear those echoes is a challenge to us to not forget what made this country the great, wonderful America we are. People at work. And what they're saying to us, don't forget. Don't give up. Build it again. We can do it.
Paid for by Americans for Harkin.
That's Tom Harkin running for president in 92. And apart from the reference to the current president at the time, that's an ad that word for word you might see today, which only means 26 years later, Senator, we haven't seen growth in manufacturing. And in many ways, you were in Washington when the great manufacturing decline happened. And I want to ask you why you think that happened.
Boy, that's take a lot of time, I think. Well, let me put it this way. I think part of the anger and the frustration and part of what I think brought Donald Trump to the presidency has to do with the fact that from the 70s, mid-70s until now, working people's wages and standard of living has stagnated. In fact, has gone down. I mean, they may have made a little bit more, but inflation outstripped it. Middle-class Americans today realize that their children are probably not going to have as good a life as what they had. That's completely opposite of what we've always had in America. The next generation was always going to go up the ladder a little bit more. And I think people may not know how to express that or talk about it, but I think it's felt very deeply around this country that we've had misguided economic policies for all those years and how it focuses on working families, working people in America. And I think that's led to a lot of the anger and frustration that you see out there today.
Just want to read one more quote for you and see if you agree with this, because to me, I read this piece and I thought, Senator Harkin's going to be on the show, and you got to Washington in January 1975, right?
That's right. Yes,
and so Matthew Stoller, who writes for a number of different organizations from a sort of a left-leaning perspective, he wrote a piece for the Atlantic Monthly titled How Democrats Killed Their Populist Soul. And I will read what he wrote there, and I'll see if Senator Harkin agrees. He writes, quote, "It was January 1975, and the Watergate babies had arrived in Washington looking for blood. The Watergate babies, as the recently elected Democratic congressmen were known, were young, idealistic liberals who had been swept into office on a promise to clean up government, end the war in Vietnam, and rid the nation's capital of the kind of corruption and dirty politics the Nixon White House had wrought. Over the next 40 years, this Democratic generation fundamentally altered American politics. They restructured campaign finance. They took on domestic violence, homophobia, discrimination against the disabled, and sexual harassment. They jettisoned many racially and culturally authoritarian traditions. But the result today is a paradox. At the same time that the nation has achieved perhaps the most tolerant culture in U.S. history, the destruction of the anti-monopoly and anti-bank tradition and the Democratic Party has also cleared the way for the greatest concentration of economic power in a century." End quote. So what Stoller is saying is your party before, roughly by the time, and I'm not blaming you, I don't think he's blaming you, before you got there, was sort of in the Brandeis tradition, in the anti-monopoly, in the trust busting, not allowing these massive mergers, huge single employers. And the fact that Stoller sees Democrats as going Republican light, he thinks has killed manufacturing and hurt us as a country that makes things. Do you agree with that?
Well, I never read the article, but it sounds like something I'd agree with. I think he's on the right track, which leads me to say something else that will probably disturb a lot of people. I assume it comes as no surprise. I'm not a big fan of Donald Trump's. But, you know, in a lot of things that Donald Trump said in the campaign, man, some today, there's always a grain of truth. But then he takes it too far. Yes. We lost manufacturing in this country, and we needed to rebuild it. His solutions were wrong on what we needed to do. And yes, I think my party, the Democratic Party, shares a lot of the blame for that. We did not fight hard enough and do the things necessary so that in the division between capital and labor, how much of our national wealth goes to capital, how much of it goes to labor, we didn't fight hard enough to make sure that there was a balance. More and more of our national wealth went to capital, financial services, financial dealings, and not enough to the kind of tax benefits that would enable companies to rebuild plants and modernize them and and adapt the new technologies that we could do in this country. I'm not saying that everything that went overseas could have stayed here. That's not rational. But I think a lot of it could have. I think with the right tax policies and economic policies, we did not have to lose our steel manufacturing in America to Korea first and China, Japan, Korea, and China. We didn't have to lose all that. But we just let it go. Because why? The financial interests said we can make as much money off of making steel in Korea or China or Japan as we can here. In fact, we can make more. So let it go there. That's the tilt towards making America a financial center rather than a manufacturing center.
Let's get back to the subject at hand in our final minutes. I've been told to remind our listeners that the event tomorrow is not open to the public. So we've been talking all hour about this event. So Ms. Hetherington, we should probably mention to folks, Susan, it's going to be an important event. It's going to be impactful, but don't show up at the Strong tomorrow because invitation only, right?
It is invitation only, and we hope the entire community will get behind the work that is going to take place tomorrow. But the summit itself is a small problem-solving day that focuses on getting businesses, organizations to do just what Senator Harkin said, is appreciate the benefits of hiring people with disabilities and to understand that it is good business to do that.
Stephanie and JD, since we're down to our last couple of minutes, I want to give you the floor to let us know what you want to leave listeners with as we think about employment, opportunity, and what it really means in this community. JD?
I think what we want to accomplish with the summit, you know, Starbridge and SCDD, what we want to do is we want to leave with a call to action to folks in our community, especially like the business owners that come in or the advocates or the family advocates, to have a conversation. I'm a firm believer that in this community we leave too many things unsaid. And even if tomorrow we just say some things out loud that haven't been said before, hopefully it will lead to someone doing something different than they have in the past. Also, I'm for hire, so if you find me somewhere and you need anything,
take every opportunity, JD.
You know, I'm using the hashtag #HireJD. My name is spelled J-E-I-R-I, so you can find me places. But I'm really just be open to it. You never know what you'll find.
Okay. Stephanie, what do you want to leave the listeners with as we I'm curious to know if you think the march of progress for people with disabilities is on a roughly steady, if slow-moving, straight line upwards, or you know, I also wonder if you think we've stepped back in any way.
I think as an activist, what I like to remind myself and all of my staff is that you have to stop and look at the progress. Otherwise, you'll start to feel like nothing's moving forward. Mm-hmm. So it was actually when I was interning for Senator Harkin, when we were taking a picture together, he like looked and he's like, see, you just came up that curb cut. Without the ADA, that curb cut wouldn't have been there. So sometimes I just have to look at the curb cuts to remind myself that we are making progress. But there is a lot of progress left to make. Employment's important, but someone stuck in a nursing facility can't get employed because you can't get out of there to get to your job. So we've got to work on that as well. But also, the Center for Disability Rights is here to help local employers. If you don't know what your responsibilities are as an employer, we want to help you. If you don't know what the rights of your disabled employees are, then let's help you. If you don't know what a reasonable accommodation is, call me, because all we want is for our community to be more inclusive, more welcoming of disabled people, so that we can all grow better together. We are a city that is in poverty. All of us are. So let's get out of it together, and let's not leave anybody behind, especially disabled people.
And in our last 30 seconds, let me read an email from Tess, who says, I want to echo Senator Harkin's assessment that those with disabilities regularly rise to the best of employees. As a customer, I've had good, reliable customer service at the Penfield Target, where I regularly check out with cashiers who have visible disabilities, such as deafness. These are connected. My aunt went to the Iowa School for the Deaf at a time where her hands were slapped for using sign language. When you were her senator, Senator Harkin, you signed to her. Our family always recognized how important she was. You were the first politician to do so. Bless you. From Tess. Awesome stuff, isn't it?
That's where my brother went to school.
Awesome stuff. Well, listen, Senator, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate the work that you have done on this and continue to do. And great to have you in Rochester. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Good luck with that 6-year-old you're picking up.
I'm going to pick up a 6-year-old. But for all of wherever you are this afternoon, think about what you've heard from Stephanie Woodward from the Center for Disability Rights and J.D. Flores, who's working with the ROC Employability Conference tomorrow. Susan Hetherington from Rochester Strong Center for Developmental Disabilities. Thank you to all of you. And good luck tomorrow on another outstanding and important event for our community. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Evan.
Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful afternoon, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.